usually was not as fertile as the land they were used to having, or was the type of terrain that they were not familiar with. And many different tribes were thrown together on a reservation, not giving thought to if they were friendly with each other or if the tribe was used to farming or not. We're going to look at the role reservations have played and continue to play in the oppression and attempted elimination of Native people with my first guest.
Bleak.
Oppression.
Small.
They're beautiful and sad at the same time. It's beautiful because you're surrounded by people that are just like you. But it's sad because everything that affects big cities, whether it's drugs or alcohol, or everything's magnified on a reservation. You see it up front, like in your face.
Sick. You know, there's alcoholism, there's abuse, there's domestic violence, there's a lot of things that go on a reservation that really goes overlooked.
Just a compromise. It was an agreement based, well, forced agreement probably, that Native Americans were put kind of out of the way, out of sight.
Man, prison. It's like where we're trapped.
I think it's the most common misconception about reservations.
That there's some kind of abundance, that natives are happy, that they're caring for each other, that they live in some ancient way.
Ooh, sad.
Poor.
A concentration camp. Reservations were made to isolate Indian people and hope that we would die off.
Depressing.
Unfair. Because they're not as good as other lands. They're the land that the government and people don't want.
Trapped? It wasn't great farmland, it wasn't great homeland, and so it kind of feels like a place off to the side.
Even to this day, the natives are fighting for rights, to keep the little what they have.
There are no good reservations. Here's your reservation. You can't go across that boundary. This is your reservation. And I grew up on a Navajo reservation, and we're one of the few lucky people that got to remain where our homelands are. But there are other reservations where people were forced there, and they can't fend for themselves like they used to do in the old days. You can't hunt anymore, you can't fish anymore. Because you're just stuck on a reservation on these substandard housing, living in third world country conditions. Youths killing themselves because there's no future, there's no hope. That's a reservation to me.
Very sad indeed, and one which hopefully makes us think of what Native Americans have gone through and what they're going through even right now at the hands of this white settler colonial entity. Well, let me get our first guest onto this program to give us a first-hand perspective of all of this.
Juan B. Mancius, the tribal chairman of the Carrizo Comecrudo tribe. Juan is the eldest born through a lineage of hereditary chiefs of the Carrizo Comecrudo, but also descends from the Tasuki Pueblo and Kikapo nations. He has held leadership roles as an assistant tribal administrator with the Kikapo Traditional Tribe of Texas and the tribal administrator of the Scotts Valley Band of Pahwa Indians of California and the Alabama Coushatta Tribe of Texas. Today, Juan focuses on decolonizing both tribal people and others. He has written a 12-step decolonization program and presents it frequently at conferences and seminars.
Well, thank you so much for being with us. Welcome to Hidden Files. Can you tell us about the role reservations played in oppressing the natives?
At the very beginning, I think a lot of the reservations that were set up were set to confine and to change our life ways to the lifestyles. And there's a difference between those life ways and those lifestyles. Our life ways are our traditional values and our traditional beliefs compared to the ideals of lifestyles. that was brought here by the colonization, and that became very oppressive because we were practically being brainwashed to change, to accommodate, you know, the colonizers over here. And so for a long time, I think, I know that a lot of our relatives were on other reservations were not allowed to leave the reservation without permission, and that's become commonly most of the undoing of losing a lot of our language, losing a lot of who we are. Of course, you know, then by doing that, they stole a lot of the land.
Well, what are other techniques used by the Europeans, in your perspective, to oppress the natives?
I think that for the longest time, the big oppression in this area has been, you know, the Spanish mission concept of coming in and trying to, they were cutting our hands and cutting our legs and, you know, hanging us and to try to, so those that didn't want to convert. And that happened throughout the, you know, the Middle Americas, what is called Americas now. So there's a lot of oppression based on being forced to learn one language and to forget your language. The boarding school system was one of those. The missions of this area of the Southwest were another one of those. To the Southwest and through California, they were very oppressive to who you are, who we are, and they outlawed a lot of our ceremonies.
And I mean, what would you say are some of the main problems that natives still face today?
And that's what they did here with the doctrine of discovery. They said if we don't believe the way they do, or live the way they do, that they could kill us. And that's what they did for a long time. And here in Texas, up until the 1940s, they were still killing us. And they were finding ways to take away the land, and that's how they did it. And we're, you know, there's still a high percentage of prisons that have a large percentage of people of color. That should tell you something too. But they still want to control what's there. And if you speak very loudly, you get they'll find ways to get you. So thing is that they like their system the way it is, and it's only for them. And for the rest of us are just supposed to suck it up, you know. And that's no longer the question here. I'm not here to make the white man comfortable anymore. I'm here to make my people comfortable. So,
and with that, we appreciate you being with us right here at Hidden Files. Well, stay tuned. We're going to welcome our next guest to the program right after this.
Terrence Nelson, Vice Chairman of the American Indian Movement. Terrence is also spokesman for the Oki-Ida Warrior Society. He's former chief of Roseau River Anishinaabe First Nation and has written numerous books and booklets.
Thank you so much for joining us here at Hidden Files. How are reservations still being used today, in your perspective, to repress natives?
Well, one of the things is that you can't pledge any lands, you don't have access to the banks because you can't pledge anything on a reservation land. You're denied access to the economy. So the United States, the indigenous peoples living on reservations are probably, you know, they're the most impoverished people because it's deliberately set out like that so that the indigenous people don't have the money to fight the system that they find themselves in. So it is it's economic repression.
Well, there are so many tragic events in Native history. One is the Trail of Tears, even significant by its name. Can you talk about this event and others that you think may even affect your people today?
Well, on the Trail of Tears, they just rounded them right up, and they force marched them to Oklahoma, and but that was only one area where they ended up doing that. Amongst the Dakotas and North Dakota, South Dakota, they basically rounded up the people and they forced them onto reservations. And then when they didn't want to do that, like there was There was lots of different, highlights in history where the indigenous people fought back. That's why you have names like Sitting Bull, Brazier Horse, and those ones that, like Geronimo, and those ones that have come through history that fought back. They fought back, and they were just small groups of people most of the time. They didn't have a lot of weapons and guns and things like that. They basically fought back as best they could. And the United States Army was extremely well equipped. They had all kinds of manufacturing of Gatling guns. They had all kinds of cannons. They had mounted horses and armies and fighting against people that were just essentially had to. They hauled their women and their children and their living, and they basically slaughtered all of the buffalo so that the indigenous people didn't have anything to eat. But there was, those are things that people don't understand. Yeah, when you don't have anything to eat, when you have your children, you're looking at your children that are starving, and you're trying to fight back. Well, that's what the indigenous people did. And that Trail of Tears you talk about, that's what they did. They essentially force-marched them, and they fed them whatever little that they had, and then they basically just, the indigenous people were falling off, and they were dying. It was because when you, as a parent or as a grandparent, when you see these little kids dying, how horrible is that? People don't understand that. The policies even extended to the residential school area, they call it here in Canada, but on the American side, it was called the boarding schools, where our Native Americans were essentially taken from their homes when they were 3, 4, 5, 6 years old, and taken to a school run by the churches and run by the, and they were forcibly indoctrinated into Christianity. And they were told that they were devil worshipers, these kids, that their parents were heathens and everything else like that. So that's the way that they were taught. What's tragic right now is that the Native Americans and our people are, we don't, know the true history of what happened to our people, because the one that controls history or the textbooks and the is the ones that essentially write the books, and it is the Europeans that wrote the books. So the Trail of Tears is not well known in the U.S. school system, and then they kind of come along and they tell these young white people that the Native Americans are dependent people, that they get their free money from the United States government and everything else like that. Meanwhile, nobody talks about all of the resources that are sold to keep the to subsidize the Native the American lifestyle. So the gold, the silver, uranium, platinum, oil, trees, water, everything that is now owned by the Europeans and sold to everybody else, they don't pay it to the indigenous people. They pay it to the corporations and to the governments that sell these products. But it was originally owned by the indigenous people.
Indeed, it is a sad story what happens and continues to happen to the indigenous people. Thank you so much. I appreciate you being with us. Well, I started off this program by talking about so-called poems and TV shows that ignore the humanity of the natives. And this is still a problem and is endemic of settler colonialism. When it is said that they, the white man, the European, discovered this nation and that they birthed a nation from nothing, these lies add to the facade of white supremacy. Now, the very roots of the United States were laid by Native and African genocide and displacement, when in its own constitution, Thomas Jefferson writes about the merciless Indian savages. How likely can we expect the change in the way Washington deals with the original people of that land? As violence is the foundation of white supremacy and imperialism is nourished by exploitation, it is more likely that viewing and treating natives as less than will continue. So it is the natives themselves who must continue to demand their rights and not remain silent. I end this program with a quote from a native chief, Hedmat Toyolaket, who said, "Let me be a free man, free to travel, free to stop, free to work, free to trade, where I choose my own teachers, free to follow the religion of my fathers, free to think and talk and act for myself, and I will obey every law or submit to the penalty. Otherwise, it seems that resistance is the only way." We will definitely be continually to bring you the latest on the natives. For now, though, that's goodbye for me and all the crew right here at Hidden Files. Thank you so much for being with us, and let us hear from you, from your corner of the world. I'm Marzia Hashimi.
Option for today and a better tomorrow. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood ghudde saratani Israel mukhalifin.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
Wajh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Palestine became top issue in Islamic world due to Imam Khomeini and Islamic Revolution. This is the part of a speech delivered by the leader of Islamic Revolution, Imam Khomeini, on June 4, 2023, on the occasion of 34th anniversary of Imam Khomeini's demise. Today, we have thousands of resistance cells in the mosques and religious assemblies across the country. From these resistance cells, young people arise as the defenders of the holy shrine. Young people arise as defenders of security. Young people arise as the students of besiege. The promising point amid the enemy's all-out effort, in a situation where the enemy is fighting completely openly, is when a revolutionary student is sworn at with the filthiest profanity at university, yet refuses to back down. A seminary student is tortured and martyred because he refuses to utter the words that the enemy wants. People who do jihad selflessly, the defenders of the holy shrines, those who actively strive in the jihad of clarification, the faithful help groups, and those in jihadi construction camps are all the youth of this country. Even with the internet, with social media, and with all the stumbling blocks that exist, our youth are moving on this path.
دنیای اسلام یک
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Sometimes we see that a spiritual person, an enlightened, luminous individual, arises from a small village, like Mustafa Sadrzadeh, a self-sacrificing, luminous young man who came from a village near the town of Shahriyar. We have plenty of people like Mustafa Sadrzadeh all across the country. We have the thousands of them. These are all promising points. We all have a duty. The educated elite have a duty. The revolutionary nuclei have a duty. Activists in universities and seminaries, those with a higher social status, especially those who can be heard by the people or whom people listen to, they all have a duty. Our duty is to strengthen people's faith. We need to provide hope. We need to clarify misunderstandings, and we need to foil the enemy's methods of creating doubt and despair. Let me tell you that one of these strategies is to cause the youth to become pessimistic toward the country's officials, the country's movement, the country's political movement, the country's economic movement, and to make people pessimistic toward one another. This is one of the enemy's schemes.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Marking the anniversary of a devastating migration tragedy, human rights activists in North Africa have denounced Europe's policy toward asylum seekers who risk their lives on land or at sea to reach the continent. The Maghreb Social Forum on Migration, FSMM, issued the condemnation in an annual gathering held in the northeastern Moroccan town of Nador at the weekend. The event brought together rights activists from Morocco, Algeria, Tunisia, and Libya, as well as international non-governmental organizations and African migrants associations from Spain, France, and Belgium. The participants commemorated the deaths of at least 23 African migrants who perished around this time last year trying to cross into Spain's North African autonomous city of Melilla. The incident occurred as around 2,000 people, many of them Sudanese, stormed the frontier in a bid to reach the Spanish territory. Some sources put the death toll at 37, with 76 still missing. The Moroccan government says some migrants died after falling from the fences, while others suffocated as people panicked and a stampede started. The forum called for a transnational solidarity pact with migrants, while refusing European pressure for the externalization of European borders and massive expulsions of migrants and asylum seekers. The FSMM also rejected a revision of the European Union's rules by the bloc's interior ministers to supposedly pressure member countries to share the burden of migrants and asylum seekers more equitably. It appeared for independent commissions of inquiry to be set up to look into migration tragedies in the region. The forum's annual meeting came hot on the heels of the latest migration tragedy, which sent shockwaves through the international community. Earlier this month, an overcrowded fishing trawler carrying as many as 750 migrants, including around 100 children, sank in the Mediterranean Sea. The boat was traveling from Libya to Italy when it capsized off the coast of Greece. Dozens still remain unaccounted for. According to the International Organization for Migration, over 2,400 migrants died or disappeared in the Mediterranean in 2022. And so far this year, nearly 1,200 such cases have occurred. Across the world, there are currently more than 89 million displaced people. Of them, 36.1 million are refugees who have fled to another country. This is a historically high figure, which shows that a large number of people are in need of protection. European countries are among the most popular destinations that asylum seekers seek refuge to. However, many European countries also have little to be proud of. In total, EU countries have provided protection to 3 million refugees over the last 10 years, which corresponds to 0.58% of the population. The Dublin Regulation is an agreement between European countries that determines who is responsible for processing asylum applications. In essence, it states that the first European country where refugees arrive must process their asylum applications and provide protection to those who are entitled to it. For a long time, this was not complied with in practice, and most of those who arrived in Greece, Italy, and Spain would travel on to countries further north in Europe to seek asylum. The refugees themselves often wanted to seek asylum further north, and the Mediterranean countries were happy to avoid the responsibility. In recent years, this has changed. The large influx of refugees to Europe in 2015 led to the EU to demand that the Dublin Regulation be practiced consistently. This made it clear that the Dublin Regulation has a major shortcoming. It lacks a distribution mechanism that obliges other EU countries to relieve those nations which take responsibility on behalf of the rest of the bloc. In 2015, the EU adopted a temporary relocation scheme that required other EU countries to receive asylum seekers from Italy and Greece for a period of 2 years. The decision was met with great opposition, especially in countries such as Poland, the Czech Republic, Slovakia, and Hungary, with all refusing to accept the number imposed on them. The strong opposition meant that there was no permanent arrangement for sharing responsibilities when the temporary agreement expired in 2017. In recent years, therefore, Italy and Greece have largely been left to themselves. They have received financial support from the EU to strengthen their asylum systems, but while some EU countries have voluntarily chosen to accept some refugees, most have refused to do so.
Israeli settlers' violence against Palestinians has been on the rise. In the latest development, the settlers in the occupied West Bank village of Umm Safa, near Ramallah, attacked Palestinians and torched two of their homes on Saturday. The residents of the village said the attack happened after Palestinians prevented settlers to build an outpost in the area.
What happened today has been going on since Thursday. Settlers tried to set up a settlement on village land, and Palestinian families have been stopping them for 2 days. The families, together with villagers from nearby, tore down this outpost yesterday. It looks like the settlers didn't like it, so they attacked us this morning from many sides of the village.
The attack followed an anti-Israeli operation in which at least two Israelis, including a soldier, were injured at Qalandia checkpoint north of the West Bank city of Al-Quds. Israeli troops killed a Palestinian who opened fire on regime forces. The 18-year-old was shot by live bullets. The Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigades, the military wing of the Palestinian Fatah movement, took responsibility for the attack. In another incident, Israeli settlers rampaged through Palestinian towns in the occupied West Bank on Wednesday, setting buildings and cars on fire. Health officials said one Palestinian was shot dead during the settlers' attack, while at least one other was critically injured. The attack followed a similar assault on Monday. Backed by the Israeli army and military choppers, Israeli settlers raided Jenin refugee camp, killing at least 10 people, including a 15-year-old girl. Israeli forces shot her in the head while she was filming the regime's armored vehicles. Dozens of Palestinians were injured, some of them critically, during the incursion. Palestinian resistance fighters conducted a retaliatory operation in an area between the cities of Nablus and Ramallah, killing 4 Israeli settlers there. The fighters were killed in exchange of fire with Israeli settlers and troops. Palestinian resistance movement Hamas claimed responsibility for that attack. The Monday raid came as residents of a number of other Palestinian towns have reported settler violence in the area. The recent attacks by Israeli settlers against Palestinians have been to the extent which has drawn reactions from not only the Palestinian officials, but also international rights bodies. The Palestinian Foreign Ministry has blamed the Israeli Prime Minister and his cabinet for the violence. The ministry says the attacks, which are incited by some far-right Israeli ministers, is a policy adopted by the regime's cabinet to murder Palestinians. It also condemned rising crimes committed by the Israeli forces. The United Nations called for an immediate end to violence in the occupied West Bank.
This week's violence in the occupied West Bank risks spiraling out of control, fueled by strident political rhetoric and an escalation in the use of advanced military weaponry by Israel. This sharp deterioration is having a terrible impact on both Palestinians and Israelis, and we call for an immediate end to the violence.
Lawrence was particularly referring to the Israeli Monday raid on Jenin refugee camp. He called the Jenin attack a major intensification of the use of weaponry, more generally associated with the conduct of armed hostilities rather than a law enforcement operation. The UN official said international human rights law requires Israeli authorities to ensure that all operations are planned and implemented to minimize the use of lethal force. He said Israel must urgently reset its policies and actions in the West Bank in line with international human rights standards, including protecting and respecting the right to life. The recent Israeli settler violence against Palestinians is, as their foreign ministry says, rooted in extremism and far-right mentality of Netanyahu cabinet. Testimony to that is a recent call by Israeli far-right minister Itamar Ben-Gavir for the assassination of thousands of Palestinians. The hawkish minister has also thrown his full backing behind Israeli settlers and called for the construction of more settlements in the West Bank. The recent Israeli settler violence against Palestinians and the growing power of far-right groups and religious hardliners in the Israeli cabinet are very alarming. If the regime does not put an end to such practices, what could not be beyond doubt is another intifada waiting to happen. Not only that, such provocative moves will eventually make the entire region erupt in flames. The situation was tense on Saturday between Russia and Wagner, a mercenary group fighting alongside the country's military in the Ukraine war. The tensions all started late Friday after head of Wagner Group ordered what he called a march for justice against the evil of the military. Yevgeny Prigozhin vowed to topple Russian military leaders. In an instant reaction, the Russian Defense Ministry said Wagner fighters have been deceived into an armed rebellion by the group's chief. The ministry said Prigozhin has dragged members of the mercenary group into a criminal adventure. It urged Wagner fighters to return to their bases, saying it will guarantee their safety. Russia then declared an anti-terror operation in and around the capital, Moscow. The Kremlin called for Prigozhin's arrest and opened a criminal case against him amid the ongoing rebellion. The comments came after Wagner's chief said his forces had entered Russia from Ukraine and gained control of a military site in the city of Rostov-on-Don. The move drew a strong reaction from the Russian president. In a televised address, Vladimir Putin said his country was facing treason.
We will not let this happen again. We will protect both our people and our statehood from any threats, including internal betrayal. And what we're facing is precisely betrayal. Excessive ambitions and vested interests have led to treason, betrayal of the country, its people, and the cause for which the soldiers and commanders of the Wagner Group had fought and died side by side with their other units.
Putin said Moscow will give a harsh response to traitors.
I repeat, any internal turmoil is a mortal threat to our statehood, to us as a nation. This is a blow to Russia, to our people. The actions we will take to protect our homeland from such a threat will be harsh. All those who consciously chose the path of betrayal, who prepared an armed mutiny, who chose the path of blackmail and terrorism, will suffer an inevitable punishment, will answer both before the law and our people.
The Russian president said the armed rebellion staged by the Wagner mercenary group was, quote, a stab in the back to Russia. He called the mutiny a deadly threat to Moscow and said his country would defend its citizens against all threats. Putin underlined that those who seek to create chaos. Yevgeny Prigozhin said President Vladimir Putin was deeply mistaken in calling rebelling Wagner fighters traitors and ruled out surrender. He added nobody plans to turn themselves in at the request of the president or anybody else. As tensions escalated between Russia and Wagner, head of the mercenary group denied calling for a coup. Yevgeny Prigozhin said he was reacting to military strikes that allegedly killed 2,000 of his forces. But what is Wagner and what has it done so far? The group, officially known as PMC Wagner, is a Russian paramilitary organization founded by Prigozhin and has been operational since 2014. Wagner is seen as a private military company, a network of mercenaries, or a de facto private army of Russian President Vladimir Putin's former close ally Yevgeny Prigozhin. The group operated in support of Russian interests and received equipment from the Russian Ministry of Defense. While the Wagner Group itself was not ideologically driven, various elements of Wagner have been linked to neo-Nazism and far-right extremism. Wagner recruited its soldiers from Russian prisons in exchange for their amnesty. The organization spearheaded Russia's battles in eastern Ukraine while being at the forefront of the months-long assault for Bakhmut, capturing the city for Russia at huge losses. The group has been active in so many other countries around the globe, but has always denied involvement. In Syria, the presence of the mercenary group was first reported in October 2015, almost a month after the government in Damascus asked for Russia's help to fight against the Daesh terror group. Wagner was notably involved in both Palmyra offensives in 2016 and 2017, as well as the Russian army anti-terror operation in central Syria in the summer of 2017 and the Battle of Deir ez-Zor in the same year. Again in 2017, there were reports that Wagner was present in South Sudan and possibly Libya. However, those countries are not the only African nations that Wagner has had a military presence. Central African Republic, Madagascar, Mozambique, Mali, Burkina Faso, Chad are just to name a few. There are reports that Wagner has also had its military activities in Moldova, Serbia, Venezuela, and some other countries around the globe. To the Wagner's rebellion against President Putin, the mercenary group decided to take back forces to its bases following a one-day military escalation. But the mutiny marked the most serious challenge to President Putin's rule and Russia's most serious security crisis since 1999 when he came to power.
Thank you. The U.S. is reinforcing its illegal occupation in Syria. That's according to the Russian president's special envoy for Syria. He said the U.S. is strengthening its military contingent in northeastern Syria, as well as in Al-Tanf, adding that the U.S. occupation forces in Syria continue to coordinate with terrorist organizations with the intention of carrying out more acts of terrorism in the region. This Russian announcement may be directly related to the U.S. military deployment of F-22 fighter jets to the West Asia region. The U.S. has cited increasingly unsafe and unprofessional behavior by Russian aircraft in the region, and this dogfighting is what the U.S. is accusing the Russian military of doing. According to the U.S., on several instances, Russian pilots tried to dogfight U.S. jets over Syria. The U.S. says the Russian pilots did not appear to be trying to shoot down American jets, but they may be provoking the U.S. in order to draw it into an international incident. It's hard, if not impossible, to sympathize with the U.S. After all, the U.S. has provoked Chinese Air Force in the South China Sea, including its Navy. Furthermore, the U.S., simply put, is in Syria illegally, and it insists it will stay there indefinitely.
My understanding is that the mission continues in Syria.
Breaking down the Russian accusations, first on U.S. training terrorists. This accusation has been repeated many times ever since the war on Syria broke out by the U.S. These two sources reveal in what ways the U.S. uses these terrorists along with the different objectives. One indicates the U.S. instructs the terrorists to target the Syrian government forces, while the other accuses the U.S. of using them to target Russia. The U.S. has time and again stated that their mission in Syria is to kill the Daesh terrorists.
The focus here is, from a United States standpoint, on ensuring that terrorist organizations like ISIS cannot reconstitute. We've obviously made a lot of progress toward that end since they first originated, you know, en masse back in 2014. And we don't want to see that progress be wasted.
U.S.'s stated goal, however, stands on a very weak footing. On the one hand, the U.S. is stealing and selling Syria's oil. These scenes took place in Syria's northeastern province of Hasaka. Convoys of tanker trucks seen shipping oil from Syria's oil-rich areas to U.S. military bases in neighboring Iraq. The Syrian oil ministry said the U.S. and its mercenaries are stealing an average of 66,000 barrels of oil per day. But why is the U.S. stealing Syrian oil and siphoning it to Iraq? Two reasons, Israel and Iran. Both Israel and the U.S. have acted against Iran and Syria, even though Iran is there in the capacity of military advisors at the invitation of the Syrian government. The U.S. has accused Iran of attacking U.S. forces in Syria.
To underscore, in response to a pattern of Iranian and Iran-backed attacks against U.S. personnel and facilities in Iraq and Syria, and the continuing threat of future such attacks, the United States has taken, and as necessary, will continue to take military action against the IRGC and its affiliates.
The U.S. president has even ordered strikes against what it calls Iran-backed forces, retaliation to an attack that killed an American contractor while wounding five U.S. troops.
U.S. military forces carried out a series of airstrikes in Syria, targeting those responsible for attacking our personnel.
Iran has flatly rejected the U.S. accusation. Now comes the Israeli factor. There's a strong possibility that the U.S. presence in northern Syria may have to do with Israel, who has continuously attacked Syria throughout the past years. Israel has targeted Syrian and Iranian targets repeatedly, killing and assassinating Syrian government forces, including Iranian military advisors. Russia is now stepping up to the plate and confronting the U.S. Air Force, while providing aerial support to Syrian government forces against foreign-backed terrorists. This may be indicative of a new conflict, however, erupting between Russia and the U.S. in Syria, in addition to U.S.'s proxy war against Russia in Ukraine.
Choose to think better.
Welcome to a better you. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
In its early May offensive on the occupied Gaza Strip, the Zionist regime unlawfully destroyed Palestinian homes, often without military necessity, in what amounts to a form of collective punishment against the civilian population. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Palestine Chronicle wrote, Ahmad and Hassan Abdullah are two brothers with autism. On May 13th, during the latest Israeli regime war on the besieged Gaza Strip, their already challenging life was turned into a nightmare. At 5 in the morning, shrapnel from the Israeli Iron Dome system hit their house, located in the crowded Jabalia refugee camp in the northern Gaza Strip. Consequently, a major fire broke out. Khaled Mahmoud Abdullah, 51, is the father of Ahmad and Hassan. He told local media about the terrible day. We saw a cloud of black smoke rising and a state of fear and panic spread among the members of my family. I have two sons with autism and two daughters. Khaled continued, Our neighbors started screaming. The sight was terrifying. The flames were very high and red. What hurts me the most, he said after a moment of silence as the man tried to control his emotions, is that the fire destroyed all the handmade toys my wife had made for our two sons, Ahmad and Hassan. The two brothers' only safe shelter, their swing, and their little dolls had been reduced to a pile of ashes. Zainab Abdullah, the mother of the two boys, said, Ahmad and Hassan used to play with the toys I made for them. The Israeli occupation does not differentiate between children, women, and sick people. Autism is a neurological disorder characterized by difficulties with social interaction and communication and by restricted or repetitive patterns of thought and behavior, according to Maha Azam, a psychologist at the Palestinian Association for Autism and Rehabilitation. Azam added that life is especially difficult for autistic patients in the besieged Gaza Strip due to the Zionist regime's blockade and the continuous wars, pointing out that these patients would need more family and community rehabilitation programs. Also, according to Wafa News Agency, in its early May offensive on the occupied Gaza Strip, the fabricated regime of Israel unlawfully destroyed Palestinian homes, often without military necessity. Amnesty International investigated 9 Israeli regime airstrikes that resulted in the killing of civilians and in the damage and destruction of residential buildings in the Gaza Strip. Three separate attacks on the first night of bombing on May 9th, in which precision-guided bombs targeted three senior Al-Quds Brigade's commanders, killed 10 Palestinian civilians and injured at least 20 others. They were launched into densely populated urban areas at 2 a.m. when two families were sleeping at home, which suggests that those who planned and authorized the attacks anticipated, and luckily disregarded, the disproportionate harm to civilians. Intentionally launching disproportionate attacks, a pattern Amnesty International has documented in previous Israeli operations, is a war crime. According to Wafa News Agency, on May 9th, Israeli regime forces began a five-day offensive on the Gaza Strip, apparently targeting members and facilities of the Al-Quds Brigades. The Israeli regime attacks killed 11 Palestinian civilians, including 4 children. The Ministry of Health in Gaza reported that 190 people were injured, of whom 64 were children. The Israeli regime military operations damaged 2,943 housing units, including 103 homes which were completely destroyed. At least 1,244 Palestinians have been displaced due to their recent offensive, according to numbers provided by the Palestinian Ministry of Public Works. At 2 a.m. on May 9th, Israeli regime airstrikes hit a two-story building in the Ashafa district in Gaza City with GBU-39 bomb, a small diameter bomb manufactured by Boeing Defense, Space and Security, and exported to occupied territories of Palestine from the United States. The strike targeted the apartment of Khalil al-Bahtini, a senior member of Al-Quds Brigade. It killed Khalil al-Bahtini, his wife Leila al-Bahtini, and their four-year-old daughter Hajar. The neighboring apartment was also struck, killing 19-year-old Dania Adas and her 17-year-old sister Iman. Ala Adas, Dania, and Iman's father told Amnesty International that he was woken up by his bedroom door falling on him. He ran to Iman and Dania's room and found his daughters in bed. Dania, whose wedding was due in July, was already dead. Iman, a keen student with dreams of becoming a doctor, was still breathing and was rushed to the hospital, where she died a few hours later. The Zionist regime's deliberate destruction of civilian homes also took a heavy toll on civilians in the Gaza Strip, including on people living with disabilities. On May 13th, Israeli regime forces targeted a four-story building in Jabalia refugee camp. The building was home to 42 people from the extended Naphan family. 5 members of the family live with disabilities, including 3 being wheelchair users. Hossam Naphan, an eyewitness to the attack, told Amnesty International he had received a call he believed to be from Israeli intelligence officer at around 6 p.m., saying residents of the building had 15 minutes to evacuate. Hossam told the caller that there were people with disabilities in the building and they needed more time, but the caller just repeated the warning. After the strike, 22-year-old Hanin Naphan was so traumatized she found it hard to talk, saying that her wheelchair had been buried under the rubble of her home, so she could no longer move around independently. Research by Amnesty International found no evidence that Naphan building and other residential buildings destroyed or damaged during the last 2 days of the offensive had been used to store weapons or any other military equipment, or that rockets had been launched from there, direct vicinity. the unlawful attacks on Palestinian homes and the illegal blockade imposed on Gaza since 2007 are part and parcel of the Zionist regime's apartheid system against Palestinians, which amounts to the crime against humanity of apartheid under both the Apartheid Convention and the Rome Statute.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Iruba Shavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
Tehran has hosted an international conference on reviewing the human rights situation worldwide and its challenges as a result of the United States' double standard policies. Addressing the event, Iran's Vice President for Legal Affairs, Mohammad Dehghan, said that dozens of documents against U.S. sanctions have been prepared to counter such measures.
The U.S. administration used every illegitimate means to achieve its sinister goal and sought to destroy the Iranian government by putting pressure on the Iranian people. In the field of sanctions, a heavy case has been prepared against the U.S. Dozens of documents against these sanctions have been prepared, and every measure is taken to counter the sanctions against Iran.
Iranian officials and experts believe that the gravest violation that can be committed against human rights is to politicize an issue, and this is exactly what the United States has done.
America's actions are not consistent with the commitments made in the 1948 Covenants and Declaration and other human rights documents. U.S. authorities have proven that wherever their legitimate interests and national interests require, they leave human rights documents aside, and whenever they want to oppress other governments, people, and societies, they act upon the claims of human rights violation.
The American Human Rights Week occasion in Iran marks a series of tragic incidents, all falling within the same time frame, killing hundreds of Iranians in the early years after the victory of the 1979 Islamic Revolution. One of the most tragic incidents was the 1988 shooting down of an Iranian airliner by the U.S. Navy, or the 1981 bombing of the headquarters of Iran's Islamic Republic Party. 73 leading officials, including the then Justice Chief Ayatollah Mohammad Beheshti, were killed in the blast.
U.S. government tries to portray itself as a great savior for the world, which is really just a big lie or a great deception, because we have seen, especially since September 11th, that the U.S. has killed many tens, if not hundreds of thousands of people, and has also made probably more than 1 million people, or maybe even more than 2 million people inside of the greater Middle East region. It's the U.S. government has made these people homeless.
People here say that the American version of human rights is a jab at Washington to question its dual take on human rights and to expose it to the world.
The participants believe that terrorism and sanctions are the main pillars of the American version of human rights, in the absence of which the U.S. will not be able to continue its hegemony dominance and plots across the globe. Salman Kujurib, Tehran.
At shops and markets across the U.K., there's only one big topic of conversation these days: inflation. The rate at which prices are rising is taking its toll. For well over a year now, prices have been rising at the fastest rate in decades. Each trip to the shop is getting worse and worse for those who can least afford it.
Perhaps this right here illustrates how bad things are. A pretty standard shop of white bread, milk, butter, and flour. About a year ago, around $9 for the whole thing. Today, around $15, and that excludes energy and rent.
And while prices have soared, incomes haven't, forcing public workers to take to the streets demanding better pay over the past year. There are all sorts of reasons for the inflation, the high energy costs, the COVID bounce back. But there's also a very UK-specific explanation.
It's called Brexit.
And that's red tape, that's delays, that's the need for certification and bureaucracy. Supply chains have got disrupted, and that pushes up the price of food. And of course, a tighter labour market also, because we don't get all those EU workers coming in, you know, that help produce, you know, cheap food for the British people.
Another sign of the times, more people falling on hard times. This food bank in northwest London, one of the tens of thousands across the nation, has seen a surge in the number of people asking for help.
We've certainly noticed an increase in demand this year compared to last year because of the cost of living crisis. In fact, we've had to change our food bank policy because we were consistently giving out 300 food parcels a week for the past few months, and we're unable to keep up with the demand. And we can see that the guests we're supporting are really struggling.